live and in color from the NBC News radio broadcasting studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel from the Turf Sup radio studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening. Well, hello again, and welcome to the Water Zone Show this evening, and it's a nice, beautiful, rainy day, and we need that here in California.
Certainly need the rain. So, you know, the lead into the show where you says from beautiful sunny Southern California, not so true today.
No, it's not. That's Mr. Chris Davies, also the host of the show. Chris, welcome again.
Thank you, sir.
Haven't seen you for at least 5 minutes.
Yeah, 5 minutes, yeah. Something like that. But, hey, we got this atmospheric river here.
Absolutely.
Plowing through Southern California and the Southwest.
We should have played Diana Krall's song. Cry Me a River.
Cry Me a River, yeah.
We'll have to do that next time it rains.
Cry Me a River, build a bridge, and get over it.
Yeah. That's a good thing to do. But it's pretty bad out there right now. You encountered that road over on 14th Street.
Yeah, it was terrible. So bow backed up, and you could see 3-4, I don't know, maybe 5 feet of water underneath the train overpass.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Crazy.
Pretty bad.
A lot of traffic as well. So people pulling a U-turn right in the middle of lanes, and oh, my goodness.
Well, I'm glad we got here early and set up and ready to go. Everything's perfect, and we have a perfect audience today, and we have a perfect guest up next, and that's Miss Chris Austin, who is the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, the one and only. Chris, how are you?
I'm doing great, and it is so nice to see the rain coming down. Not that it's going to do a whole lot of good for our drought, but it sure is nice to have some rain. It's going to make the landscape green up really nicely.
Yep.
Why won't it do any good for our drought?
Well, you know, our water supply doesn't come from here. Oh. It comes from, you know, Northern California. And actually, I do think they are getting some of this. But actually, this storm and the storm that we had a few days ago, primarily located in the south.
Right.
So we're getting lots of precipitation here. And we are, you know, there are stormwater capture projects around the region, but not to the point that they can catch all this water that's coming down. But, you know, just the water on the landscape and going into the soil and, you know, helping out our plants and washing your car and, you know, all the great things that a real good soaking does. It's really great. And, you know, there's doesn't seem to be concerned about debris flows, so, you know, let it come. Let it rain.
Well, the only thing I hate about the rain is that my puppies want to go outside for a walk. and when I take them out, they could care less about the rain. They just stand there, and I'm soaking wet, and I'm trying to pull them to come back in the house, and it's just a toughie, so...
And so, you have to handle the other end of the lease.
Yes,
leash.
Leash.
No, well, I had to go to the grocery store today, and we were out of soda. And you know, the only way you can efficiently buy soda is to buy them in multi packs.
Yes.
So I had to buy 7 12 packs of various kinds of soda. And then I had to load them into my car in the pouring rain. So it's like they're still in there, but they're all sopping wet. So I'm like, when we take them out, we can't just grab them and go. It's a mess. I hate having to grocery. Anyways.
No, everybody, all the retail stores, especially food stores, are going to all these multi-packs. I mean, that's where they're telling you save a lot of money or you get a family pack of steaks.
Well, it's the demand. It's consumer demand.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but then you split it up. I mean, we buy at Costco, and we routinely buy a big pack, and we package it up into servings. But anyways, this doesn't have to do with water, and we're supposed to be talking about water.
Absolutely. Well, Chris here mentioned about the drought, and the drought is expanding in California, not going away.
Yeah, that's right. That was a trick question, Chris. I was trying to lead into that.
Well, hold on.
And you know, I mean, there's not a lot of snow up in the mountains, and hopefully we won't have a repeat in 3 weeks when they take the next snow survey, you know, that we had many years ago when Governor Brown stood in a field of, you know, brown grass that should have had, you know, several feet of snow on it. You know, and this brings up the question, you know, we like to think that we got out of the drought, but did we ever get out of the drought? You know, it may just be a drought that got punctuated by a wet year or two, and that has happened in the historical record. That they've done, they've looked at the tree rings, and they have determined that there have been, you know, 200-year droughts in California. It didn't mean that it never ever rained, but that, you know, you might get it might rain a whole bunch and flood, and then the next year it's dry. So, you know, the drought that we got out of, or we thought we got out of, we may not have really ever been out of. So we're just going to have to see. It's just it's a new world and a new climate out there, unfortunately. You know, there is another story about the currents in the ocean are shifting northward. And, you know, the ocean currents have a lot to do with the weather that you experience on the continent. So, you know, there's just a lot of things are changing. And actually, I would say things are changing faster than our science and our technology can catch up with. So, you know, hopefully we can kind of close that gap. But we're definitely seem to be entering into, you know, new territory.
If I look at the reservoir and lake map for California, I look at the pool levels that are reported on that map, it looks to me as though it's encouraging, Chris. Is it really not painting a true picture?
You know, yes, we have water in storage, but if we have a dry year, how much of that water do you want to let go, and how much do you want to carry over if next year is a dry year? I mean, we can't drain our reservoirs. You know, it's, some reservoirs are designed to have carryover storage, but others, like, for instance, San Luis Reservoir, which is over by Los Banos, its design and its function is to, you know, take excess water from the Delta during the summer, during the wet months, and, you know, drain it down awfully darn low to take that water out to the farmers. And it's not intended to have carryover water supply. It goes up and down. It has, every year. But if if there's no water to fill it up, then there's no water for the farmers. I mean, it's really hard to know how much water you should let go. And that's why, even though we have, you know, some fairly robust reservoir storage, the water allocations right now are sitting at 15%. And we're going to have to see, you know, where it goes. If we get a lot of snow in the next 3 weeks, then maybe they can, you know, up that percentage. But, the hard part is, it's kind of like, you know, your savings account. If you have unpredictable employment and it looks like you're going into a dry stretch, how much of your savings do you pull and how much do you try and hoard?
Sure.
You know, it's really hard to say. And, you know, I think these water managers are in a really tricky position because, you know, if they guess wrong, they're going to get hammered.
Yeah, a bit of a balancing act.
People are going to be mad, and farmers are going to, you know, are going to lose a lot of money, perhaps go out of business.
Yeah, hopefully the storms next week will be better. I'm looking at my 10-day weather forecast, and it's got clouds with rain coming out of them for the next 10 days.
Yeah.
So hopefully those storms happen up to the north too. You know, up because we've seen it. It seems to be in the last couple of years that we've actually had some, you know, more snow in the southern end of the state than the northern end of the state.
Yeah, especially the last year.
Yeah, cutoff lows.
Yeah, but the southern end of the state, we don't have the ability to, capture all that because we're not used to having, abundant snow in the southern part.
We should invent big fans to blow the clouds north.
Well, this particular storm we have right now is a cutoff low, right? So it's coming in from, directly from the west, where standard lows or Gulf of Alaska lows come on shore in northern California. And so as the case next week, they're showing a cold storm. It'll drop 10, 15 degrees by the weekend storms.
Yeah, so there's some hope that we'll get some more snow on the ground, although, people are saying, it's not looking likely that we're going to have kind of a miracle storm that comes and saves us from drought conditions.
What? No March miracle?
Yeah,
well, we're halfway through March, and,
and there's not going to be March Madness either, so we all lose on that. Hey, what's this thing I hear that they're going to remove Klamath Dam?
They're going to remove. Oh well, yes, they've been trying to remove these Klamath dams for many, many years. I mean, it's actually quite a long story. I think it goes back probably 15, 20 years. The dams on the Klamath River are they've been problematic because they have a lot of problems with toxic algae blooms. Even before we got them all over every place where we have them, they would have problems up there on the Klamath River, and it's been very devastating to the salmon runs on that river. And it's a private corporation, Pacific Corporation, which is like in Oregon, that runs these hydroelectric dams on the Klamath River. And they came up for relicensing. And one of the things about relicensing is that when that happens, you have to respond to, they kind of reevaluate the whole project. And you have to respond to concerns that the public brings up. And so there's, what's happening when a lot of these projects go to get relicensed, it's all now about fish passage. Because when we built these dams, we didn't understand that the salmon needed to get up to the rivers to spawn and, recreate and keep themselves going. Most of these dams were built, like when they built Fryant Dam, when they were in the middle of construction, the workers were baffled because all these fish started coming up the river, and they were trying to get over the structure, and they were just, beating themselves to bloody hell trying to, into this solid.
Oh, you can hear it. You can
structure.
Hear them. I think I can. I think I can.
Yeah. I mean, they were like, what is this?
Yep.
This going on. We didn't understand that the fish needed to get up to those streams. And so, there's been a lot of issues with the Klamath Dam. And so they actually, many years ago, negotiated a whole resolution between all the parties, and that resolution needed the blessing of Congress, and Congress did not act on it, which was actually a real blow. We all want to talk about, collaboration and come together and finding a solution, and then they do that, and then Congress has to approve it, and Congress did not approve it because there are those in Congress that don't want those dams to come out.
Yeah.
So it's a big controversy, but, they're still trying to take those dams out, and they have a public corporation that has funding, and they're going to try and take them out next year. Hmm. So, we'll see.
We will see. The other big story I heard was the Representative Josh Harder's Save Water Resources Act. That's getting rid of, that gone through their committee, and now they're going to put it in front of everybody up in Sacramento and see if they pass it or not.
Yeah, we'll see. It's looking good for it. That it's going to pass, but you never can tell. It's Congress, right?
You never can tell.
Yeah,
it's never
like,
can.
I think flipping a coin, winning the lottery is probably a better odds than what we see on some of these things. It's been crazy. But, Chris was just looking at the weather thing, and for the next 10, 15 days, it's going to be hopefully raining and get some decent fill. And,
yeah, I'm looking at the TV news here that's showing me 7 days of rain. Although Sunday, say 20%, so not, it doesn't look like, it looks like we might get a break. But, you know, we really need it. No one seems to be concerned about the debris flows. We're not hearing about that. So, I mean, this is all good. We're going to come out of this, and we're going to have the beautiful green hills, you know, that make us look like, I mean, it's only just weeks a year when you have the beautiful green hills.
Well, I know you don't like to go out in the rain, Chris, but maybe you have to do that. You got to stock up on, sanitizer and septic wipes and toilet paper and water.
Soap and water, folks. Soap and water. No need to panic. Soap and water like your grandma used.
Absolutely. Well, anyway, we got to run off here to our commercials, and we want you to stay dry. And we appreciate you coming on every single week. And for our listeners, please go to mavensnotebook.com, take a look at it, become a sponsor of it, get her reports every single day, and you'll be smarter than us because she prints everything that's perfect.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome, Chris. Have a great week.
Okay. All right. You too. Good evening.
Thanks.
Stay safe.
Good evening. Thanks. All right, we're going to take a little break. A word from our sponsor. We'll be back with our next guest. And everybody, stay dry, at least if you're in Southern California.
Time to take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. Such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure-regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high-efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi-based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Oh, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Oh, welcome back to the Water Zone, and for the second half, we have a great guest coming up. Our next guest is Mr. Kyle Pickett, And he is the co-founder and chief operating officer at Urban Fabric, located in San Francisco. He's responsible for the consultancy's West Coast operations. His leadership has established that firm as an influential and reputable community partner for inclusive technical training and successful sustainability projects. Kyle is also the co-founder and executive director of the William J. Werther Foundation, which is a 501c3 public benefit corporation. It conducts research and creates outreach initiatives on the planning, design, construction, performance, and most important, beauty of the built environment. So we'd like to welcome to the Water Zone, Mr. Kyle Pickett.
Thank you very much, guys. Great to have you here, Kyle. So listen, I'm going to start off because I know that there was a building project that Urban Fabric is kind of famous for, called the 181 Fremont Building. So let's start off by having you tell our listeners a little bit about that project.
Absolutely. So 181 Fremont is a development through J. Paul Company. They're holding on to this building as part of their long-term portfolio and strategy. And just for those that are listening, this building is situated right next to the Salesforce Tower in San Francisco and the Salesforce Park, the Transit Park. It is two-thirds commercial, one-third high-end luxury residential, and the client had a goal of a LEED 2009 Core and Shell Platinum. And when my firm was hired for this, we recognized that the only way for a building of this particular scale to reach the LEED Platinum certification was through a renewable strategy. So geothermal wasn't going to work, solar wasn't going to work, none of those were going to work. And the only way to get there from a points perspective was through an on-site water recycling methodology. We realized that no one knows how to design for it. As we started digging into the details, while, you know, these technologies existed in Australia and Japan and Israel, it was still relatively new for those of us, especially on the West Coast. And so going through the process of design and permitting and what's the regulations and the, you know, the pathways for operations and maintenance, you know, for these systems, we recognize that the design industry, the AEC, the architecture, engineering, and contracting community did not have a really good sense for how to design for these systems. So ultimately, 181 Fremont has been built. It is mostly occupied. The two-thirds commercial space is occupied by Facebook and Instagram. And then the one-third luxury residential is getting occupied as well. The on-site water recycling system is going through commissioning at the moment, so it's not in full operation. But we are targeting the LEED Platinum plaque certification this next year. So really, really exciting project that really kicked off our firm and started us down this pathway of water reuse.
Kind of curious question. How did you convince the one-third residential people about what you wanted to do with the water reuse system? How did they take that initially?
Well, thankfully, there were no residents yet, but ownership actually was really adverse to putting in a water recycling system. They were concerned that there would be a color differential, you know, looking in the toilets. There would be odors. So really took the design team and ownership a trip to Sydney, Australia to kick the tires and lift the lids on some of these systems to better understand that these technologies have been in use and successfully in use for many decades. But to your point about the occupants, we did work directly with J. Paul's sales team to help them with the messaging. What does it mean from like a water stewardship perspective? How much is this building going to save in potable water on a yearly basis? And just for you and your listeners, it's going to be about 1.7 million gallons of potable water a year saved. What they found is that they didn't really end up needing that training. A lot of the owners that were coming in, or a lot of people that were coming to buy those luxury units, thought it made a lot of sense given the state's drought epidemics and water stewardship, environmental stewardship. You know, as part of a larger conversation, was really important to them as well. So it didn't really take much.
I know you've met Paula Kehoe in the past.
Yeah.
And probably worked with her a lot. She sees a big boom in that. And I guess there's regulations now for all new big commercial buildings that they need to put in a reuse water system.
Yeah, yeah. So my my business partner, Bill Werthen, who passed away 3 years ago, Bill was instrumental in the creation and the crafting of that language, working with Paula Kehoe and Supervisor Scott Wiener that mandated any new construction in the city and county of San Francisco over 250,000 gross square foot incorporate a water recycling system of some kind. And so that's where a lot of that started. And our insights in working on this particular project contributed, you know, from like the developer perspective as well, because developers in general don't want to do things they don't want to do that will cost extra money. So it has to come through as far as like this mandate for that environmental stewardship piece.
So there's lots of various codes, which and your business is pretty unique, as both as a consultancy company and you also help design things. How do you, you have a great tagline, connecting policy and practices with design. How does that mm-hmm. transition or transpose with the customers in how they think and how they look at your organization, what you can bring to the table?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Well, I mean, building certifications such as LEED and WELL and others is essentially the bread and butter of what we do. We're a small firm where, you know, an architect or, you know, developer will bring us in to make sure that they hit their sustainability targets. But we do so much more than just a building, you know, certification. We take a look at it from a holistic perspective. What is the messaging and the marketing components to this? We are a sustainability consulting and communications practice. So what does it mean for developers, for the stakeholders, for the facilities people that are, like with 181, that will be operating a gray water reuse system, you know, going into the future? What is it that they need to know? And so it's not just communicating what they need to, what kind of credits they need to hit with in like a LEED scorecard, for example, but it's also communicating the value, you know, of this particular sustainable design, whether it is a water recycling system or if it's a building that's going to go all electric, which we're seeing California building codes heading toward. So it's, you know, empowering the owner, empowering the developer to make the best design decisions, not just from a first cost perspective, but what is it, you know, down the road as they hold on to that building as part of their long-term portfolio and strategy.
All right. So that's good. I mean, let's talk a little bit more about your mission, if you don't mind, Kyle, for Urban Fabric. I noticed in the lead up to this, as I was reading some of the notes, that a comment you made or a comment that was written that says, our services bridge many of the professional knowledge gaps that exist between today's business as usual practices and those required to successfully realize high performance outcomes. I guess my question is, how did you discover this gap existed? Was it experience or?
You know, it's funny. Developers, you know, historically has been about, you know, that first cost. You know, so design quickly, build it quickly. Make sure that you know your associated cost for materials and the vendors and the suppliers and all of that that comes along down the line. What we've discovered though is that as we continue to advance this and building codes continue to advance to a more sustainable or green design kind of centric building code, that we've noticed that developers are much more interested in hearing what is that long-term investment. Not just from a monetary value, but then also from an occupant's perspective. So like, just to kind of give you an example, it's not one of our it is one of our projects from a Blackwater permitting and design perspective, but Salesforce Tower in San Francisco has incorporated some really high level sustainable design principles from a material standpoint and has really created a space where people want to work. And so that's one of the things that developers are actually starting to better understand is that their building holds a longer term value proposition if they invest in initial first cost that goes towards things like healthier materials, you know, water stewardship, energy stewardship. And so the shift is happening and developers are starting to come on board and Urban Fabric has actually been part of that answer in communicating that value to developers, especially in the San Francisco and New York market.
Is the maintenance, say, like we go back to the water reuse system, maintenance a large expense as they look at the long-term value for what they're going to get?
You know, it's a really good question, and I think it's dependent upon a project-by-project and technology-by-technology basis. Our firm, we try to remain agnostic when it comes to specific technology recommendations. Whatever is the right technology for the right client and the right project is what we try to advance. But when it comes to that long-term O&M, there are some regulatory and rule pathways that need to be cleared. Right now for Blackwater systems, there is a mandatory daily testing requirement, which is not the most cost-effective for an owner. But what we are seeing is we're seeing that those things are changing and that the code and the regulatory environment is evolving to take those into account. And, you know, part of it, too, isn't just from a regulatory or rules perspective. It's also from a public health perspective, especially if we're talking about gray water and black water systems. So we're seeing some projects that are starting out with a black water system that will have a return on investment, you know, further down the road. But that only really happens for a developer that is holding on to that building as part of their long-term strategy. If their strategy is to build it and flip it, not so, that doesn't work so well, which is part of the reason why the mandate is also in place, especially in the city and county of San Francisco.
I heard you say a little bit earlier that part of the mission for Urban Fabric was to, quote unquote, demystify the technical, right? So, I mean, there's a ton of stuff you've got to go through to get this stuff and hoops and, you know, fiery hoops to jump through and hurdles to get over. Describe a little bit, if you can, that approach to your customers in the demystifying the technical.
Yeah, definitely. Well, when we step into a meeting for a project design team, for a large project, not everyone is speaking the same language. You know, everyone is there to represent their particular trade or their particular craft and to build the best building that they can. Sometimes information gets lost in translation. And so we see part of our role is to bring these teams together and make sure that there is a culture of willingness to learn and to understand not just what people know already, but what are some of the things that are part of the goals of this project that we can help demystify that technical through an effective communication between the design team members. So as an example, with 181 Fremont, the plumbing engineer and the plumbing group that was in there, while they were familiar with water reuse from like just a high level perspective, what does that mean for practical applications? So we need to dual plumb. You know, is there an associated air gap? You know, what does that mean? Is there odors? I mean, just the whole suite of things that we can help, you know, bring the big idea down to earth and demystify those technical components through effective communication within the design team, and we help facilitate that.
Educational programming, is a big part of your approach to your customers as well. Is that right?
That is correct, and that's actually also part of the reason why the foundation was formed. We wanted to provide technical guidance that, you know, that really brings the information down to a digestible level, along with informative infographics. And so, I do not know of any organization that would be willing to grant money to a for-profit entity to develop this kind of work, which is part of the reason why the 501c3 was set up, so we can ask for that kind of funding. Organizations like Google and Microsoft have seen the wisdom of what we're trying to do, the value in what we're trying to do, and provided us with funding so we can put that technical information to accessible education for the industry. Everyone is so busy. Everyone is so crazy busy. It's like, how do you keep up with all the stuff that's happening? And we feel that, you know, through the cutting edge work that we're doing on the for-profit Urban Fabric Inc. side and flipping it into free, accessible, professional, meaningful education through the nonprofit side, means that we can help make a difference.
So I know you judge your success of your business by measurable outcomes, but do you also escalate the customer's requirements by the education portion? And in most of the meetings that you, when you first get contacted by a prospective client, what do you ask them aside from what they think they want? I mean, how do you take them to the next level so they get the whole picture?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, we're usually not the big player in the room. And so recognizing, you know, that there are recognizing and understanding the politics and the dynamic within a project team means that we can come into a room and be disarming. We have the opportunity to say, hey, have you considered carbon sequestration in your concrete mix? Have you considered, a lower level of fly ash? Have you considered an on-site water recycling system, even though it's not part of a mandate? Let us tell you why. You know, that's not necessarily just a first cost, but it's a long-term value add, from a marketing and an occupant perspective as well. I'm not sure that fully answers the question.
but on your Fremont bill, let's take a different project that you may do.
Yeah.
An organization or a developer builds a building and makes it LEED certified. What happens to that building, in your experience, have you seen, does it maintain that status, or do you see some deterioration or lack of support for that after it's done over the years?
You know, LEED, it's really amazing how much LEED has grown. I was just in a meeting a couple weeks ago with the CEO of the United States Green Building Council, and they were talking about how LEED is not only growing in the United States, but it is also making leaps and bounds in areas like China and India that are now starting to see the wisdom in building better buildings, that the status quo is not good enough and that there is an opportunity to do better, that results in better occupant health, and higher levels of sustainability. What we've noticed here is that the LEED certification, once it happens within a building, is that plaque goes on the front window or in the front wall in the lobby, and ownership is proud of it. So it continues to bring value to an owner, because we're seeing more tenants, more occupancies where there is a leasing arrangement, and they want something that is better for their staff, where there is a better work productivity. And LEED, a lot of the principles within LEED towards health and happiness actually brings that.
Well, what happens at a period of time, say 5 years down the road, I don't know if you've experienced this, and the developer or the owner of that building now wants to sell it? Does the building have to go under recertification to validate the effectiveness of that LEED status?
At this time, it does not need to go under a recertification process. I know that the USGBC and future iterations of LEED is looking at a verifiable performance basis recertification process. Unclear what that's going to look like, but let's also keep in mind that today's version of LEED is leaps and bounds above the first iterations of LEED back in the 90s, where we were talking about bicycle parking. There was no conversation about EV chargers. There were no conversations about on-site water reuse. It was about water efficiency within fixtures. But today's version of LEED is much more stringent than what the first LEED was. So LEED will continue to evolve, and I think the industry is really looking forward to not just proving that LEED certifications can be done at the onset of design and that building once construction is complete, but what is the long-term verifiable performance metrics that come with a LEED certification status?
Yeah. Now, I'm involved for my work, my normal work, with the National Association of Home Building. I'm on the Green Building Standards Committee for Water Efficiency. But there's other things in the marketplace aside from LEED. You have ResNet and all these things. Where are they all going to fit in? Because I can see a builder developer, he gets to choose which one he wants, but it seems that there's so many different variables between all of these different certifications.
Yeah.
Where do you think that's going to wind up in the end? Is it going to be everybody's going to have a different one, or are you can select the one you want, or it's going to be mold them all into one? What do you think?
I really good question. So one of the things with USGBC, the United States Green Building Council, and the Green Building Certification Institute. So the Green Building Certification Institute is not just certifying for LEED, it's also certifying for WELL and other building certifications that have slightly different focuses. One of the things that, one of the certifications that's out there, for parking structures is a certification called ParkSmart. There's a long-term parking garage number 2 in San Francisco International Airport that we're a project that we work on that particular project, and they are aiming towards a ParkSmart certification. Building certifications in general focus in on slightly different things. So like the WELL building standard goes towards like health and happiness. There's the FitWell. There's Green Globes. There's BREEAM that is very much in deep inroads in Europe and other places, and they're just kind of getting their start here. I think what we're going to see in the future is we're going to see a coalescing, that there are certain principles that are common to all of these certifications, whether we're talking about the initial core and shell, the initial design parameters for use of concrete and carbon sequestration and other things like that. We're going to see an alignment of parameters around material resources. You know, these things cannot have formaldehyde. there's a whole red list of chemicals that are not part of this, part of the material supply chain. We're also seeing a lot of manufacturers. There's called the LP50, and that's the living product, big group of 50 manufacturers that include like Interface Carpets and others that are really working to advance, a sustainable supply chain infrastructure, where it does, it goes beyond LEED. It goes beyond these building certifications. So I think what we're going to see, you know, in the long term is we're going to see much more of an alignment, between these building certifications, but they all pretty much focus on the same thing.
Yeah. It just seems to be every time you go to a different city or a different application, we see it here in California with the water, different organizations trying to put their procedures in place. We had one, a builder who puts in a automatic irrigation controller, and he says it's water smart approved, or it's equal to water smart, they were going to give points to. And they gave the same points to somebody who really went through the EPA water sense approval.
Yeah.
And so I kind of argued, gee, how come if somebody says, if you and I started the business today and we developed something and say, hey, well, it's a smart controller, we automatically get points even though we didn't have to spend the money to go get it tested. I thought that was kind of funky in a way. Everybody's trying to
definitely and you know what, only experiences like those will actually flesh out where those inconsistencies are. That's one of the things that humans are really, really good at, is where's the loophole, where's the gap. So like that water smart controller, or like with an environmental product declaration or a healthy product declaration, people will find their ways around it, but that's where that opportunity to flesh out where those inconsistencies are and work to close the gap. With some of the products that we, or some of the projects that we work on where there's specific products that are specified, those are specified for very specific reasons because they have an EPD or an HPD behind it. EPD equivalent is not going to work, and I think the certifying bodies around that actually realized that within the last couple of years and have worked to kind of close the gap. And I think, to your point, that we're going to see that in the future as well.
Yeah, I hope that comes quickly, because I'll tell you, going to all these different meetings with the different standards, it's getting crazy, because one wants this, one wants the other, and it's like, you know, what do you do?
Yeah, polar objectives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and to your point, too, we have Cal Green in California, right? So Cal Green, on a number of different levels, has overlap or actually exceeds the standards set forth within LEED requirements. And then in other areas, it doesn't quite match it. So a lot of these building certifications are actually recognizing that many states are incorporating their own green building measures and supplying alternative compliance pathways. So I think that's also another part of the future that we'll see, these things are issues. What do we need to do in order to close the gap so that, you know, there maintains that fairness? It's not, you know, a wild west, you know, from a product standpoint, but it brings alignment, and clarity to the design teams and to the developer community as they build their projects going forward.
When you first sorry.
No, go right ahead.
When you first get approached by a potential client, what's, I'll use the term elevator speech, you give them to make them think differently when they come see you? Or are they, because I'm sure they have preconceptions of ideas of what they want to tell you, but what do you usually do to enlighten them into a different level?
Yeah. It totally depends on if it's a developer that we've worked with, that we have a relationship with, that we're a known quantity. Usually that's what happens for us, is that we have developers that we work with on a regular basis. They continue to come back to us. It may, be a project where it's hardwired. It may be a project where it's a part of a traditional bid process. But lead certification or a lead sustainability consultant is usually lower down on the priority list. And so maintaining those relationships with the developer community and our architecture friends is actually a really key component of my role here, because not only do we want to successfully deliver, work on time and on budget, but also, what does that future look like, and helping them, shift their focus towards one that, especially if they have kids, what is this? We see a world that's changing right now. And what does this future look like for them? And so part of the thing is getting to know them personally as well. These relationships are really important. If it's a developer that we have not worked with previously, it's learning more about the project. What are some of the goals? Identifying maybe a pinch point or two that they might be having trouble with, or providing a little recommendation, between floors in this elevator pitch. But it's really about getting to know, our client. What is the driver, for the development of the project? What are some of the goals? What they would like to see some of the outcomes, come from, and helping them guide them into a direction where it helps them achieve that outcome. And our developer friends trust us, to be able to do that. And that's what we're known for.
Yeah, I kind of see it as a, from my perspective, looking at you guys, it's like a balance between the cost versus sustainability and what they really want, and how they view that.
And I got to say, it's a much easier sell if the developer's goal is to hold on to the building as part of their long-term strategy. Some of these first costs associated with, better materials or solar, PV, just, the various range of options that are out there, especially looking into the long-term operations and maintenance of a building, if they're incorporating these sustainability strategies, those costs will go down over time. So they will recoup on that initial investment. But it's that first cost that a lot of people are struggling with. And actually, to that point, I last year moderated a panel on commercial real estate and resiliency within the San Francisco market. And, we were talking about now how banks and financial institutions and insurance companies are starting to see the light when it comes to sustainability and resiliency, and are rewarding, developers and their customers with, better premiums. Or with better financing, because they are starting to take a look at this. And that's coming from like the state, from SASB. It's called the Sustainable Accounting, Standards Board. And so now it's also starting to look more attractive to developers, because from a financing and from an insurance perspective, they're starting to get rewarded for incorporating some of these strategies.
It's kind of like, when you buy a new car and they ask you if you want your car seat heated, most people don't want to spend the money, but then when they call me, they wish they had it.
Right.
Go ahead.
It's a small cost associated with the overall budget, right? So if there's an opportunity, to incorporate that for just an additional small cost, and then you'll really like it, and it will pay dividends, in the future. That's definitely something that we try to communicate with our developer community.
let me kind of focus on just one sort of, you know, 30,000 foot view here, right? Because I see, you know, this whole evolving same sustainability effort that we see going on in lots of different business sectors, including ours here for Rob and I's day job, as he mentioned earlier. But so it's just something I see as very exciting, and I encourage to see Urban Fabric really focusing and shedding the light on the importance of sustainability and applying new technology and doing it cost effectively. Just to, you know, in the effort to design and build urban places that people want to live in. So the question is this, after that little build up there, is one of the statements that you made is climate positive development at any scale. So how do you know, how scalable do you see this? I mean, you know, this could go on forever.
Yeah. So we're really at the beginning stages of enlightenment when it comes to sustainability practices. And I'm using that as a really broad overarching term, whether we're talking about a water stewardship strategy or we're talking about the water energy nexus, which, you know, is inextricably linked, what we're talking about for, you know, materials. From a scale perspective, we're just beginning. We're at the beginning of a really, really exciting time, and I think, you know, from the perspective of, you know, the COP23, you know, or sorry, we may have to strike that part, but the Paris Accords, you know, that there's a lot of angst, you know, within, you know, the global community about where we're headed, as far as our environment. And, it's really encouraging to see that the building sector and that the product sector is really getting on board. So what I mean by climate positive, we're talking about things that will not take away from the environment. We're talking about things that will not contribute to emissions, carbon dioxide emissions. We're talking about things that will give energy back to the grid. So buildings make a difference. Exactly. Buildings that will make a difference, not only in our fight for environmental stewardship and a better place to live, but also, you know, this is truly scalable from a single family residential level, you know, clear up to the 1,000-foot towers that we deal with in LA and San Francisco and, you know, and in other places. So, I think when it comes to this environmental stewardship within the built environment, we're really, really at the beginning of an exciting time. And that's part of the reason why I enjoy the teaching side of things. I've lectured at UC Berkeley to their Master's of Real Estate Development class, and seeing the passion that a lot of these young people are coming up with that have this passion for environmental stewardship, because they're going to be our developers and our designers and our policymakers of tomorrow. So I feel that there is a huge opportunity for the sustainability community, for the developer community in general, to teach and to mentor the youth that are coming up through these fields, and to instill that passion for environmental stewardship from the beginning, because they're going to be the ones doing it tomorrow.
Right. So sort of a side story here as I'm looking through this. Is there a story behind the name of the Urban Fabric, especially the play on spelling for fabric?
Yeah. So, yes, there is. Urban Fabric, as in the grid that connects us all, and brick, B-R-I-C-K, as the fundamental building block of civilization. So essentially what we're trying to do is connect it, that it may start with a brick, but we're looking at, to one of your earlier points too, is this more accessible, livable, walkable community as part of an urban infrastructure. And that's where we feel that the urban fabric of this world is headed, is towards those more sustainable communities that are livable, walkable neighborhoods.
That's fun. So how can some potential clients get a hold of you?
Yeah, absolutely. So, through our website, urbanfabric.com, U-R-B-A-N-F-A-B-R-I-C-K. Don't forget the K. And you can reach out to us through the contact form there.
Great. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show today. We really enjoy it. It gives our listeners a new meaning of what's happening in the world and where we should all be going. And, again, thank you very much. We do appreciate it.
And thank you. Appreciate the invitation.
All right. Thank you.
Well, that was certainly enlightening, and it was a good thing. Just real quick question. Chris, do you think everybody's going to be living together and working in the same place? Or I think we're too spread out for that.
Right. I think we are
anyway.
Too, right?
Anyway, so everybody got to have a great week. I hope you get the rain that you want. Hope you get the sunshine that you want. And most important thing we want you to do is
keep our planet blue.
KCAA Loma Linda.